AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Aid is slowly reaching the desperate survivors of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines.
We cannot eat. We can't even drink water. No water.
Toby Pickens, one of many U.S. sailors flying in supplies by helicopter from the USS George Washington.
We never want these situations to happen, but when they do happen, it's nice that we're getting tasked to go help them and bring the food in and be directly there handing them the food and seeing the look in their faces. It's very rewarding.
In the weeks since the disaster, support from countries around the region has been pouring into the Philippines. Australia, Indonesia, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan, all sending aircraft and or relief personnel. With the nuclear talks with Iran set to resume soon, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says he'd rather have no deal than a bad deal. Diane Kepley with more.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the U.S. is not willing to agree to a deal that's not in the best interest of America and its allies.
A bad deal is worse than no deal. There will not be a bad deal.
At a defense forum in California, Hagel said the reason is simple.
The stakes are too high for our country and for the world.
But he also told the forum the act of engaging Iran opens the door to reducing tensions in the region. The
engagement, as I've often said, is not surrender. It's not appeasement.
The next round of talks with Iran are scheduled this coming week in Geneva. I'm Diane Kepley.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer and two other senators are pushing for an extension of a federal law that bans 3D printed plastic firearms. The measure is due to expire on the 9th of next month, just as the technology of so-called 3D printing continues to advance. Schumer says it's at the point now where anyone with $1,000 and an internet connection can gain access to printed plastic parts that could be made into a firearm. This is AP Radio News. The Food and Drug Administration has issued a warning for defects in some Medtronic's devices used in heart procedures. AP Radio's Jackie Quinn with more.
Federal health officials say a defect in some Medtronic guide wires used for heart procedures are severe enough that they could cause serious injury or death. The warning covers about 15,000 guide wires. The company says a recall began in late October after Medtronic received reports of four complaints, including one patient who went into cardiac arrest but was resuscitated.
The recall warns hospitals and distributors that a coating on the guide wires could break off, causing the possibility of blocking a blood vessel. College football. Top-ranked Alabama overcame four turnovers to beat Mississippi State 20-7. Florida State crushed ACC rival Syracuse 59-3. Number three. Ohio State thumped Illinois 60-35. Stanford fell to USC 20-17. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Signs, so subtle we may not notice them. Signs like loss of interest in activities. Signs like insomnia, fatigue, or withdrawing from friends.
Hey, Jeremy, come play cards with us.
Even talking about wanting to die. These are signs of depression.
Hi, my name is Smitty. My husband, Congressman Jerry Connolly, and I urge you to take signs of depression seriously. Let your loved one know you care, then seek help from a doctor or mental health professional.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having three number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Dana Theus, with my co-hosts, Les Mullen, Vistage Chair, and Luca Salvi, Shepherd Mullen. Today, our show is brought to you by Bernhardt Wealth Management. We have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today. We have Lynn Oliver, President and CEO, American Security Programs; Buddy Reiser, Acting Director, Loudoun County Department of Economic Development; Sylvia Lagerquist, President and Founder, Haynes and Lagerquist CPA; and Judith Sandelow, Executive Director, the Children's Law Center. First up, we have Lynn Oliver, President and CEO of American Security Programs. Lynn, what is American Security Programs?
American Security Programs is a full-service security firm based here in the Washington, D.C. area. By full-service, I mean we do investigations, training, security consultant, as well as providing manpower.
And how big or small is the firm today?
Well, we're about $40 million. We employ over 800 security officers.
And you started the firm.
I did.
You're the founder.
I am the founder.
And I have to imagine that being in business how many years now?
Well, 20 years with this company.
So being in business, owning this company, growing it to the size it is, you must have a lot of integrity to run a business like that.
Well, I would hope so. We feel that our middle name is integrity. Mm-hmm. Our foundation is based on integrity.
And how young were you when you learned how important integrity was?
Well, I was very, very young. I guess my role model was my father. And he died when I was 9 years old, but after he died, so those that knew him, when they would meet me, they would say, "Oh, so you're Tom Oliver's son. I'll tell you that Tom Oliver had the most integrity of anybody I ever knew." And so that instilled the concept in my mind of integrity.
And what were Mom and Dad doing when you grew up, and where did you grow up?
Okay, I grew up in a little town called Grantsville, Utah. It's in the western part of Utah, little farm community. My father died, as I said, when I was 9 years old, and my mother, in order to make ends meet, took in laundry and did a little bit of everything to try to keep family and my brothers and sisters together. I was the youngest of eight.
Eight. So you were the baby of eight.
I was the baby.
What does that do to a child being the baby of eight? And they were almost all sisters.
The oldest was a boy, and six sisters, and then me. It really presents a lot of challenges being the boy, because the only boy in the family, because when I came along, my older brother had already moved on and started a family of his own.
But didn't that mean that everybody just coddled you and took care of you and spoiled you?
My sisters claim that I was very spoiled. I don't believe that, though.
What did life in Utah look like for the youngest boy?
Well, it was a very, very different way of growing up in Utah, in a farming community, than in this area, for example. Mm-hmm. Very, very different. We played outside all the time. We had to make our own entertainment. We didn't have a movie theater to go to. We just had to create our own entertainment.
And was there an interest in justice early on?
Yes, from the standpoint of playing cowboys and Indians and cops and robbers. And
did you get to be sheriff?
No. Sometimes I was the robber. But
oh, really? But you grew up to own a security company.
I grew up to own a security company. I really became really embedded in the criminal justice system when I was in the Army, mm-hmm. doing Article 32 investigations. I was a commissioned officer in the Army. I was able to go through Officers Canada School. I was very fortunate in order to qualify for that. And that kind of set me off in my career.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you said your father died when you were nine. What does that do to someone as they're growing up, losing a parent that early?
Well, my mother being the sole provider and making sure that we had bread on the table, it gave me a real perspective on life and the values of hard work, I'll mm-hmm. tell you that.
Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling you've lived into those values fully.
I hope so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did the Army give you that you use today in your success?
A lot of experience. Being an officer for 3 years, doing criminal justice, sitting on a special court martial board, looking at what can happen to individuals. The special court martial is comparable to criminal court in the civilian system.
Mm-hmm.
You had said something earlier, Lynn, about growing up, losing your dad, mom having to basically take care of and provide for you kids. But I'm wondering, as the youngest of eight, and then you said you also had another family, because your mom, I suspect, remarried?
No, it was my father. My father was the father of eight children in Idaho, and that his marriage fell apart, and he moved down to the Utah area and started a farming and another small little business and started our family.
So how young were you when you had to go out to work at that point in time in order to help out with the family? Or were they just kind of coddling you as...
No, I don't remember a time when I wasn't working. As a matter of fact, in a farm community, I grew up hauling hay. I grew up working on different farms, tending cows, helping herd sheep. I was always working.
And most kids at that age perhaps are out there taking their money and going out to the movies or whatever. But you weren't doing that. What were you doing? Where'd the money go?
To support the family. When I was old enough to work in service station, I would go to school at, I'd open a service station early in the morning, go to school, and then go to football practice after, and then go close the service station at night. So it was a constant.
So, Lynn, you grew up with these seven other brothers and sisters, mostly sisters, and then you went off to the Army. Was that your first opportunity to leave the home that you knew and the town that you knew?
No, I moved in with one of my sisters for a short period of time and started to work in construction. And then I was called on a mission by my church, and then after I came back from the mission, I went to into the Army.
I see. And then the Army opened up this law enforcement career that has in some ways morphed into what you're doing today.
Exactly. And that's what brought me here to the Washington, D.C. area, because I was recruited out of the Army by the FBI.
Oh, so you worked at the FBI for a while.
I did. And I hate to say it, you're so young, but that was back in the Hoover era.
So you said earlier that you had spent much time, you know, being the youngest, taking orders in the Army, working for the FBI, and you finally decided to go out on your own. Why'd you decide to start your own company?
I was recruited, actually, out of the Army to come to the Washington area and by the FBI, and then recruited out of the FBI by a major national security firm. And I created the Federal Contracts Division of that firm, and then I was offered an opportunity to become part owner of another company, a smaller company, and so I created a fairly good business for those two companies, and I thought, well, I could do this for myself, and that's a little bit late starting it, but that's the way it happened.
Was it more about the money, or was it about something else?
No, it was about... I think human relationships more than anything.
What do you mean? Why would you start a company to have human relationships in the security area?
Making sure that the employees are treated fairly. And It's a very competitive business. I wouldn't suggest that anyone get into that particular business or try and make a livelihood out of it at this point in time. But because it is so competitive, sometimes the employees are not treated as well as they should be in order for the company to put the money to the bottom line. And I am very proud of the fact that my employees always referred to me as Mr. Integrity. As a matter of fact, I received a plaque with that, with the word integrity inscribed.
So what you're telling us is that this sort of business myth we hear that you have to put the money towards the bottom line and not focus on the employees isn't necessary. You can still make money and treat people
you
right.
You have to give back to the community. You have to give back to your employees. And if you do that, there's going to be a certain amount that's going to fall to the company as well, and you can prosper.
All right, when you talk about your family, are they surprised at the success you've had today?
I guess so. I was the only one to graduate college and go on to graduate school. It was unusual, even for the individuals that I grew up with, to go off to college. Many of them got a bachelor's degree, but that's as far as they went, as far as the individuals that I grew up with.
What was propelling you to go do this?
A couple of things. When I was in the fifth grade, one of my friends at the bus stop looked at me and said, "Lynn, I admire you, and I admire your mother for the way she keeps you." And I didn't know what he meant. And he said, "Well, you're a very, very poor family." And until that time, I didn't know I was poor. But I learned, and that kind of motivated me to make sure that I was able to succeed in life, and education was one of the ways.
What's the website, Lynn?
www.securityprograms.com.
This is Dana Theis with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Luca Salvi. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment, right after this Business Spotlight. Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Jan Fox of Fox Talks. Jan, what is Fox Talks?
I was on television for 118 years, and I thought when I finished, I wouldn't be asked to speak or coach anybody anymore. I was so wrong, I had to start a company. After going to see a very expensive brander, I didn't find a name. My husband said, "Why don't you call it Fox Talks?" Because you certainly do.
Well, just for the record, you're not 118 years old. What makes your organization Fox Talks special?
I work with people who are scared to death to speak, or people who are really pretty good but who just want to learn to connect with the audience a little better. And I have a little system. I call it Speak Tweaks. I just do a few things to them, and I see their skin stretch right before my very eyes. I love it. They love it. And it's a wonderful life.
So what's the perfect client for you?
The perfect client for me is somebody who knows that they want to have a bigger impact every time they open their mouths. It can be somebody who's a CEO who is trying to lead his pack and nobody's following. It can be somebody who wants to be a speaker and can't get anybody to book him. So anybody who wants to have a larger impact.
And what do you like most about your job?
Can't you see my face light up?
I can hear that smile.
I love doing this because I see people grow in ways they thought they couldn't.
What's the website?
Fox Talks, www.foxtalks.com.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Luca Salvi. Next up, we have Buddy Reiser, Acting Director of the Loudoun County Department of Economic Development. Buddy, what is the Loudoun County Department of Economic Development?
We're the business arm of the local government. Our job is to increase the commercial tax base by attracting and retaining and helping our companies expand.
And how big is the organization?
We have about 24 people in our department. The county government's probably 2,000 plus.
And how did you get involved?
I took this job 7 years ago with the idea that coming from a Fortune 500 background and a small business owner background, that I could add some value and help companies grow, and thought it would be a great experience for the second phase of my professional career.
The second phase. What was the first phase?
I was a radio broadcaster for most of my life. I started when I was 15 years old on the radio and did that for about 25 years, and then bought my own radio station, which I ran for about 5 years.
15 years old, And you started your own radio program?
Yeah, I did. And it's something that I knew very young that that's what I wanted to do when I grew up.
How did you know that?
I'm very stubborn. I decided early on that was me. I was going to be a radio guy. And I put my entire imagination behind the idea of doing it. So by the time it really happened at age 15, I was prepared and ready to go.
Who actually said to you that you've got to be in radio? I mean, was there anybody that influenced that decision, or how did you come up with it?
No, I think for me, I was just looking very hard at what I wanted to do, and I got very focused on that. And the music came first, listening to the music, discovering new music. So that when
this is you as a child,
this is me
to
as a child, yeah.
What kind of music were you listening to?
Well, you know, I was started as a pop baby, and then kind of got into the rock music as I grew a little bit older.
And what was the significance for you of music growing up?
I think that it was the creative outlet. It was understanding how the music kind of changed people's lives, and I found it transformative. I never felt better than when I was listening to music.
When did you know that?
I can't remember ever not knowing that.
Really?
Yeah.
So, buddy, you were a radio guy for 25 years, and then you made your way now to the Department of Economic Development for Loudoun County.
Mm-hmm.
What did you take from your radio days that you use today in your job?
Well, I think it's all of it. It's the ability to relate to people. It's to be the ability to craft a message and be able to communicate that message. It's the ability to talk to people and understand what they need out of the experience and then be able to kind of transfer those skills. At the end of the day, sales is always going to be about communication, and really that's what I do.
And then you're also a local guy here in the area, right?
Yeah, grew up in the region, grew up in Hagerstown, went to college in Baltimore, worked most of my life in Washington, D.C., and now very happy to be in Loudoun County, Virginia.
And is that an important part of what you do today, having that local background? Does that benefit you at all?
I think it does. I think that I understand the people here. I think I understand what's important. I understand what their values are, and I can speak their language. We have common backgrounds and common things that we can talk about and understand.
Why is the message so important? Why isn't it about the showmanship?
I think that showmanship without message is just a wasted exercise. I think it's all about being able to communicate a value proposition. In my business now, what I'm selling is confidence, that companies can come to Loudoun County, that they can have the confidence that we'll do everything that we can to help them succeed. And I think that that's what we're trying to leave with people.
So I'm hearing a theme here of confidence, because you described your childhood as stubbornness, but a 10-year-old that decides to go into radio and does it by the age of 15 has got to be pretty confident.
Yeah, I think that I think most people would tell you that I don't lack for confidence on a general basis. But, you know, I think I learned very young how to set goals and how to achieve goals. And, you know, I set out to be an Eagle Scout and did that at the very youngest possible age. And I wanted to graduate college in 3.5 years, and I did that with honors. So I think that when you start to have these successes behind you, it gives you a little bit of confidence and gives you the kind of feeling that you can do things and can accomplish things.
So go back to when you first realized that this game of gaining confidence was an important part of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the people that were influencing you then? What was mom or dad doing?
Well, I think that they were always very supportive. They raised three very different kids in three very different ways. And so I give them a lot of credit for being able to do that. And I think they were always there to try to help us feel good about what we were doing and help us build on our successes.
So tell us a little bit more about the three different ways. How are you different from your other two siblings?
Well, I'm all about books and music and being out there. My brother is all about cars and hunting and is very much more reserved. And my sister is completely different than those two things. She's also very quiet and does more mathematics and those types of things, and has her MBA. And so we all grew up different and doing different things and having different goals, and my parents supported all three of us in whatever we wanted to do.
How did they do that with you specifically?
They never put any limits on me. They, you know, when you're a 10-year-old boy and your dream is to be on the radio, I think that there might be parents who go, you know, why don't, you know, you're a straight A student. Why don't you think about being something else? Or why don't you think about, you know, try to sway me? They always supported what my goals were.
So they knew back when you were 10 that this is what your dream was.
I think even before then, that was my dream, to be on the radio.
What do you think? Go ahead.
Is your work today helping small businesses in Loudoun County? Is it something about that, helping dreams come true?
I think it is. I think that, and seeing a community grow, the growth that we've seen in Loudoun County over the last 7 years is something that I get excited about. Getting up every day and going to work and helping to build that community and help businesses grow and help entrepreneurs start their business, that's really what gets me up in the morning these days.
And yet, you showed me a picture earlier. Our listeners can't hear. He's in a lovely suit, very, very businesslike. But you showed me a picture of you with Aerosmith, not wearing a suit.
Yeah, I think I was all in leather with my hair halfway down my back, and you know,
right.
Now I have no hair and $1,000 suits. So you know, things change. You know, I'm 5 years ago I was over 310 pounds. Now I'm pretty svelte, 180, and work very hard to keep it off. So
where did that desire to change your life so completely come from?
I think I just woke up one day and I said it's time to start again, time to hit Control Alt Delete. Let's try this whole thing again. And I'm very fortunate because I've been able to follow two dreams really to a very high level, and I feel very blessed by that. And I don't take that for granted any days.
Is that confidence? Does that come from confidence? Or, I mean, most people follow one track and that's it. You're saying you followed two dreams.
I didn't want to continue my old dream. I achieved what I was looking to do. So once I achieved that, I knew that I needed to set myself on a different course. I needed to reinvent and I needed to go for something different. And that's what I did.
And tell us about when you decided to reinvent yourself. Was it something that you had planned and targeted, or was it something that sort of came unexpectedly?
No, I think that for me, it became organic because I became involved with economic development commissions through my radio days, and I started to see what value there could be in having that kind of expertise helping business, and I just kind of said, well, you know what? Maybe that's what I want to do going forward.
So there's a lot of people listening to this right now who may have a dream, and it may be to change careers. And we know there's some challenges there. What advice would you give to people who really want to change their life so completely?
I think that you have to throw yourself into it completely. You have to commit to being a different person, not inside, but you have to reinvent yourself, pick up a new skill set, or at least hone your skill set and really commit to being different. Take off the leather suit, cut your hair, get a nice suit, and go to work every day. Mm-hmm. You know, I would go entire years in my radio career where I wouldn't even wear long pants. You know, it's a different thing, but you have to commit to that in order to succeed these days.
So your dreams are important, but so is doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What do you think when you look back at the story that you were kind of crafting when you were younger, and how that ties to what you're doing now?
I think it all ties together very nicely. I mean, I think at the end of the day, my goal was to succeed. My goal was to do something that was valuable, and my goal was to do something that I could be proud of, that my parents could be proud of. So I don't think that there's any one way to do that. I think that life is an evolution, and mm-hmm. when you can kind of find paths that you can follow where you feel comfortable and where you feel like you can be successful, I think that that is one of the biggest recipes for success.
Looking back, or perhaps even now, what would your parents say be most surprised about?
Boy, I don't know. I'd like to think that they are very proud. I like to think that you know, my father likes to tease, and so he says, for the first time in my life, I have a real job. He never thought being on the radio was a real job, though I know he was proud of that. But I think that he understands putting on a suit and going to work every day. So I think that they would be very proud of everything I've done so far.
And how about all those rock stars you used to travel with? If they could all be sitting here with us in this tiny little room and say, what's the one thing they take away from being with Buddy? What would they tell us?
I think that they would probably tell you that there were some wild times back in the day. You know, we did a lot of fun things and, you know, traveled around the world. You know, I used to travel around the world with rock stars. Now I travel around the world with CEOs and the chairman of our board of supervisors. It's a slightly different way of going, but it's... that was a great life, and this is a great life, too.
Great. What's the website?
You can find us at biz.loudon.gov.
This is Dana Theis with my co-hosts, Les Smolin and Luca Salvi. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment, right after this business spotlight.
How do you know you've retained the strongest business professionals to work with you on your business? For example, an attorney who successfully handled your type of problem, an accountant who sees the big picture, a business advisor who gets it, a real estate broker who thoroughly knows the market, a commercial insurance broker who has access to all the products, an employee benefits guru who mitigates future costs, a wealth manager who makes work optional, an understandable information technology wizard, a commercial banker with minimal covenants, an investment banker who knows the business is a relationship, a staffing specialist to help build the team, even a confidential peer group with whom to compare notes. Simply listen to Executive Leaders Radio, executiveleadersradio.com, to confidently select a business leader who serves business leaders, because nobody's interviewed more business leaders from Princeton through Northern Virginia than Executive Leaders Radio. You'll have confidence in your choice and ultimate selection of business leaders who serve business leaders.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin of Vistage Chair and Luca Salvi, Shepherd Mullen. Next up, we have the lovely Sylvia Lagerquist, president and founder of Haynes & Lagerquist CPA. Sylvia, what is Haynes & Lagerquist CPA?
We are a CPA firm that works with owner-managed professional service firms, and we help our clients analyze their financial information so that hopefully they can make the wisest decisions possible. Our firm is primarily located in Prince George's County. We have 5 employees and about 100 clients in our client base.
So you own the company?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you owned the company?
I started my own firm in 1993. Working from my home, and then in 2006 I purchased another accounting firm located in Bowie, which is, and moved into those offices, at what point then I took on tripled the size of the business and took on about 10 employees.
So I want to come back to that success, but mm-hmm. let's start from, where did you grow up? Were you Maryland?
No, I'm not a Maryland person. I grew up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
How many brothers and sisters?
And I have a sister and 2 brothers, and I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
And what were Mom and Dad doing when you were growing up?
My mom was mostly a stay-at-home mom until I was about middle school, and then she worked part-time in a department store. So as the oldest, really, she relied on me for a lot of helping her out with the home, cooking, doing laundry, taking care of my siblings. My dad's family has been in the grocery business, and my dad's cousin owned a wholesale distributorship, and my dad worked there as an employee, eventually owner. My brothers worked there as well.
So you were taking care of the family. Were you also working in the family business?
No, it wasn't. It was a no girls allowed business.
Talk to us about that. What does it mean, no girls allowed?
Well, it just never came up, really. It just was clear that the girls didn't get to work there. I remember when my dad was still a truck driver in the business, and I wanted to go out on his route with him, which took him out of town through the tourist destinations in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And it was a big battle, you know, oh, no, girls don't do that kind of thing, whereas my brother trailed my dad. He was called Shadow, trailed my dad in, you know, in his business as a salesperson, as a truck driver.
You just said, okay, fine, I don't have to do that sort of thing, and went off and lived in a hole.
I don't know that I would say that I lived in a hole. I maybe just developed my independence in other ways, primarily by leaving. I grew up and I left and never went back.
So that's interesting. So there wasn't an opportunity to, for you in the family business, so you left and started your own.
I eventually started my own. Right out of high school, I didn't know what I really wanted to do, and so I decided I really liked music and I wanted to major in music. I had an experience in high school where I had gone to a summer debate camp, and I stuck around with the girl from my school, even though I didn't like her that much because I was too shy to get to know the others. And so when it came time to decide to go to college, I decided I wasn't going to go to the University of New Hampshire where the rest of the class was going. I would go someplace where I would meet people from all over the country.
So how does a shy, musically inclined person end up doing what you do now?
I ended up in accounting quite by accident. I had no idea what accounting was about. I met my husband playing in an orchestra, and when we got married, we decided that we might have an instrument repair shop in a music school, and I knew that if we did that, I'd be the one to be doing the books. And so I took my first accounting class, and I really liked it. I had done well in geometry in high school, these very foundational classes. And with, you know, where you have a foundation, everything is based on that foundation. And I'm a very tactile learner and a problem solver as well, and that's the kind of homework that you get in accounting. And so I went into public accounting saying I wanted to work with small businesses and slowly learned to be unshy. You know, when you go off on your own and you're the only one that can bring in the rain, you kind of learn to be unshy.
I find this to be really an interesting story, Sylvia, but there still, in my mind, seems to be a big jump between doing the books for a business in a music repair shop and then opening up your own CPA firm.
Well,
how did that happen?
Well, clearly I liked accounting, and of course the ultimate is to become a CPA when you're an accountant. It's kind of the thing to strive for. And so I went into public accounting working with small businesses, and I would see the bosses going out to have the meetings with the clients. And that's the role that I wanted. I really didn't like being left back to you know, do the grunt work, so to speak.
You didn't want to live in that hole.
I didn't want to live in that hole. And so I decided, I was in public accounting, for maybe 8 years before I decided to just open my own shop, and I walked away with a few clients, so I had a little bit of a client base when I started.
And so going back a little bit and looking at your first career in music and in orchestra, tell us what qualities or skills from that are you using now today in your CPA firm?
Well, I was a music ed major, so I never did play in an orchestra. I did teach. I was the fine arts teacher at an American prep school outside of Salzburg, Austria, for a year. I think the skills that are very important in public accounting and the kind of work that I do is, I think I'm a kind of well-rounded person. I have a number of interests and I like different things. And since I sell a very personal service, it's about the connection that I make with the business owner. And when I have this diverse background, I find that I can make a connection pretty easily with somebody that helps them trust me and develop that relationship where they'll trust that very private information with me.
I'm curious, you know, as a woman, you know, we run into the no girls allowed rules all over the place, and too many women listen to those rules. As someone who's never listened to those rules, what would you say is the best advice you can give to anyone out there that encounters a no blanks allowed?
Well, I think that's part of the thing when you go out on your own. You just decide that you're not going to follow those rules, and then you just go and do your own thing, and you do your own rules.
Where do you find the confidence to keep going when things get tough?
That's a tough question, because I think that the image that we need to put forward is not necessarily what we're really feeling inside. And I've belonged to I'm a founding member of a small group of women business owners. We're only seven of us. And I have a weekly phone call with two of those women where we try to support one another, because we wear so many different hats, and it's such a tough world. And we're alone at the top. We're the only ones in our firms, you know, doing this. So we need to have the support of one another in order to help us get through all of this. And so, we get by giving.
Explain that.
Well, every time that I'm helping one of the other women business owners with a problem that she's struggling with, I feel I'm sort of getting something in return. You know, sometimes you need to take your own advice.
And someone can remind you that you need to take your own advice.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So in that way, I feel like I'm learning. Because in a way, it's kind of like the same consulting I'm doing with them, I can do with my clients.
You were in boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
What did it feel like to be sent away?
I didn't get sent away.
You wanted to go?
I wanted to go. I have an aunt that's only 7 years older than me, and she went for her last year of high school because she was thinking of becoming a nun and eventually did that. My first cousin went to the same boarding school. So part of that tradition of where I grew up, my mom thought it would be great discipline. And so it was something that came from me. It wasn't something that I was sent away. It was only 7 miles from home.
Ah, okay. Not you weren't sent to Austria when you were in high school.
No. The Austria thing was after college, where I went and lived in Salzburg for 2 years.
So now looking back at your experience in this boarding school, what was it that you took with you that you use today? Are there things that you learned in boarding school or a discipline, the way of life there, that helped you in your career?
I'm not sure. Maybe just a little bit of the independence and being away from home, a little self-sufficiency. You have self-reliance when you're in boarding school that maybe you don't have at home when you're living at home.
I want to piggyback off of that and ask, because this theme seems to be coming out of the conversation, at least for me, and that is you seem to be breaking barriers all the time. You break the barrier about being shy. You break the barrier about, well, you go from one, a music background, into an accounting background. What is it that surprised you most about yourself in making all these, kind of breaking down these barriers, if you will?
I'm not sure. It just seems natural. It just seems like what I do. I think there's an independence streak. Somebody else earlier talked about equity and fairness. I certainly have a strong sense of that equity and fairness as well. Sometimes the way you are, you just kind of take for granted. Other people like yourself maybe see something differently than I do.
If your mom were here today, sitting with us in the studio, would she be surprised at your success?
Oh, that's a difficult question, because I was raised with when you grow up and have a family. Well, if you're going to study music, then you should study teaching, because then if something happens, then you have something to fall back on. So it was always a secondary role, and my dad didn't believe in educating women. So with my mom, it's hard for her, and I think it's in some ways to see the success, because that's not the role model that she had for me.
Hmm. Thank you. What's the website?
www.hainesandlagerquist.com, and the and is spelled out.
This is Dana Theis with my co-hosts, Luca Salvi and Les Smolin. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment, right after this business spotlight. Joining us for this business spotlight is Lee Self, president and owner of Renaissance Executive Forums. Lee, what is Renaissance Executive Forums?
Renaissance Executive Forums is a group of business owners and CEOs who come together and learn from each other, from each other's real life experiences in business.
And what do clients appreciate most about Renaissance Executive Forums?
The ability to come together in a real high trust environment and have their thinking challenged by others who have been where they are.
Why is trust so important?
Because these folks, you know, they run businesses, they have a lot of employees who depend on them, and they're expected to have all the answers, and yet they don't. So they need a place where they can go and kind of let their hair down and talk about the things they're uncertain of.
What does your perfect client look like?
Perfect client would be an individual who's running a very successful, stable business, maybe has 100 employees, and is restless with where they are and looking to move maybe to the next level growing, or looking to move in a different direction, and knowing that they don't have all the answers.
What do you enjoy most about your work?
What I enjoy most about my work is sitting back and watching them help each other in ways I could never imagine, because they get each other.
Interesting. They get each other.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do the work for them.
No. I just get to. The most important thing I do is bring great members into the forum.
What's the website?
www.executiveforums.com.
Thank you for listening to This Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-hosts, Les Smolin, Vistage, and Luca Salvi. Next up, we have Judith Sandelow, Executive Director of the Children's Law Center. Judith, what is the Children's Law Center?
Children's Law Center is the largest legal services organization in Washington, D.C., and the only one that focuses on children. We believe that every child in the District of Columbia should have a safe family and a good education and good health. And we provide that to children, about 2,000 every year, by providing free legal services to at-risk kids and their families.
So who would be a perfect client for the Children's Law Center?
Sadly for us, a perfect client is a child in need, and there are 45,000 children in poverty in the district, so we have lots of children in need. A typical client for Children's Law Center would be a child who has severe asthma and is running back and forth to the emergency room twice a week with out-of-control asthma. And a pediatrician will actually call one of our lawyers into the examining room. And what we'll discover is that back at home, there's a leak in the ceiling and mold behind the ceiling, and we need to go in and convince that landlord to fix the house.
When you started with this organization, was it big and serving as great a community as it is today?
I started at Children's Law Center in 2000, and I was the third paid staff person. We're now about 85 paid staff.
So you've overseen that growth.
I have. We went from serving about 50 or 100 kids a year to serving last year 2,500.
So why children? Why was this so important to you?
If you'd asked me when I was heading into law school 25 or 30 years ago, I would never have told you that I would be running the Children's Law Center. But in 1995, I became a foster parent. And I fell in love with my own children, who I adopted. And then I was recruited to the Children's Law Center because fundamentally I had had the experience of all of our clients. My children have special needs, they had mental health issues, and so I really understood how important it was for children to get the help that I was able to give my kids.
So we're going to come back to the foster children, but there's a clear pattern here of you as a strong advocate for people who can't advocate for themselves. How young were you when that advocacy really started to come through in you?
I've always had a streak in me that gets angry when people aren't being treated fairly. The first thing I can remember, the first time I can really remember being an advocate was I was, I think as a 15-year-old, elected to the school board in my hometown of Ann Arbor, Michigan, as the student advocate. And angered all of my peers because the first thing I can remember fighting for was having kids, having the school bus come early for high school students so that elementary school students could sleep in a little bit.
So you pissed off the older kids so the younger kids had a benefit.
That's right.
So what did you either see in yourself or what did you see in did others see in you that said this is what you need to be doing, being the student advocate?
That is an excellent question, and I'm not sure. I think it was me, not them, thinking that students should have a voice. We're kids in school, and teachers and parents and administrators are making a lot of decisions, and why shouldn't children get a chance to speak up?
And why was that important for you? What happened back then to kind of shape your thinking around that?
I think people should have a choice about their own lives, and that carries through to today, which is students often know what will work for themselves, and school boards make decisions for us. So I was back then trying to figure that out.
Was there ever a time in your early life there where you didn't have a choice?
No, I have to say one of the things that I bring to the work is I have always had a solid foundation of family health and education, the very thing which we try and get for our kids. And I like to say I have an unreasonable level of self-confidence that comes from having such wonderful parents.
So tell us about your parents. What were they doing when you were a kid?
I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My father was a law professor at Michigan, and when I was a young teenager, he became dean of the law school, which is very much like being the executive director of an organization. So I got to see what it meant to run something. My mother was a high school teacher, taught American history and street law.
So it was a fairly traditional family?
Very traditional family. I have two older brothers, and we lived in what was then a small town and lived very well.
And were girls supposed to grow up and run big organizations back then?
You know, I was a young teenager in the 1970s, which was really when the feminist movement hit and hit in Ann Arbor. So I watched my parents navigate what it meant. I remember one of my mother's friends got divorced when I was in sixth grade, and she didn't have a credit card. She had no credit history. And I remember my mother learning from that, that even though she was in a good marriage, and it is a 60-year-long marriage, still good today, that she needed to have credit herself. So I began to see those things as I was growing up.
So Judith, let's fast forward a little bit, and you decided eventually that you wanted to become a foster parent. Tell us what led to that.
I had been a public defender, so I was representing low-income, mostly men, who were charged with a range of criminal offenses, from drug possession to murder. In the course of that representation, I saw two things. One, I saw some of my favorite clients who had themselves been so badly hurt as children, and no one had ever given them a chance. I also had a chance to go out in the community and saw many kids who weren't being given the opportunity, whose parents couldn't care for them. That, coupled with a great love of children and the fact that I was single, meant that foster parenting seemed like a wonderful way for me to parent, and I knew there were a lot of kids out there who needed it.
So looking back on that now, were you prepared for the challenges that were going to come along with that?
I don't think anyone is prepared for the challenges of parenting ever. I can say this. Here's where I wasn't prepared. I was the single parent of two small boys, and I had five clients facing life without parole. My boys needed me home at 6 p.m. My clients needed me to work till midnight. And looking back, I think how dumb it was that I thought I could do that. Obviously, I chose my children over my clients. I switched jobs. But nobody's prepared.
And so you eventually adopted the foster children that you took on?
I did. I have two sons who came to me when they were 7 and 10 years old. They're now 24 and 26.
What would the kids say about you now?
I think that, especially my oldest son, who's the best able to articulate it, mm-hmm. would say that I was always there for him. We recently were with my brothers and my father on Father's Day, and I teasingly said to my son, well, you know, how come I don't have a present? He went and got me a Father's Day card, and in it he wrote, because you were both mother and father to me. And I think he gets it, and he has a new baby girl, and I can see him communicating that level of love to his daughter.
So he has a family as well.
He does.
You must be very proud of him.
I am. He's doing wonderfully well.
So it's interesting you're talking about so many different kinds of families that you've been a part of, that you've served. And what can you tell us about family that we may not know from just having maybe one of our own?
That families come in all different shapes and sizes, and that there's no one thing that makes a family. And I say that, obviously, as a white woman adopting two African-American boys out of the foster care system, I was already breaking a lot of the rules about what family was. And my kids came with a lot of trauma. And every night at dinner, my older son, when he was 10 and 11 and 12 years old, would escalate out of control and be very violent. I mean, it was very dangerous. And yet we sat down for dinner every night. And finally his therapist said to me, something's wrong with him at that hour. Why do you always sit down for dinner? And I thought and realized, to me, that's what makes a family, dinner, sitting down together. And I was raised with that. The minute the therapist raised the issue, we stopped sitting down as a family. We were still a family. We still spent time together. But we did it in a way that whatever happened to him before I met him that triggered him at dinner time, we just got rid of it. So I say that to say it's the love and the consistency and staying around that makes a family, not dinner time or football games or any of those other things.
What was it that made you not give them back? Because they were foster children, you could give them back. Why didn't you?
I would say that tenacity is one of the watchwords I believe in. I loved my kids. My oldest son went through a lot in life. But he was loving, and I saw a lot of wonderful qualities in him, and I already loved him. You love your kids. You don't only love the good qualities in your kids.
Mm-hmm.
So your experiences as a foster parent and a parent, how do they translate into your work now with the Children's Law Center?
First of all, we have a set of values at the Children's Law Center, which was created by staff, and my favorite is tenacity. We don't give up. I hire staff for their tenacity, and I learned that if you stick by a child, they can make it through to the next place. And I hire staff with the same attitude because although we are not parenting our clients, like a parent, we need to stick by kids and see that they have a future and make that happen. So that's been one important piece.
So like a parent's experience, are there days that you're at work where you are just about ready to throw yourself out the window? Or how is that? How does that work day to day there?
I don't have those days very often. In fact, I can't think of one that I've had. You know, a lot of folks will say, how do you and your staff manage seeing children who have been so badly hurt? And one of the things I like to say is we get to help them get to the next place. So our donors don't get to see the change. We do. So that helps you to get through.
If your two sons were sitting with us right now, what would you like to tell them that you've never told them before?
I'm pretty chatty, so I'm sure I've already told them this, but I'm amazingly proud of their ability to pick up every time they fall down and keep going.
What's the website?
www.childrenslawcenter.org.
And that's a wrap. This is your host, Dana Theus. I'd like to thank our guests today, Lynn Oliver, President and CEO of American Security Programs, Buddy Reiser, Acting Director, Loudoun County Department of Economic Development, Sylvia Lagerquist, President and Founder, Haynes & Lagerquist CPA, and Judith Sandalo, Executive Director, Children's Law Center. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Les Smolin, Vistage Chair, and Luca Salvi, Shepherd Mullen. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Bernhardt Wealth Management. And finally, and most, I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can also listen to this program again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
This holiday season, with cold weather creeping in, you can make a big difference in the life of a shelter dog. The volunteers at the Montgomery County Humane Society are asking for donations of warm blankets, squeaky toys, dog beds, towels, collars, and treats. You can drop off these donations at any Bark Pet Store location in Rockville, Kentlands, Olney, and Silver Spring. Help keep shelter dogs warm and happy until they can find their forever home.
Losing more than just spare change in your laundry? By upgrading your old washer to an energy-efficient model, you can save up to $625 over the washer's lifetime. The DC Sustainable Energy Utility offers discounts and rebates on energy-efficient lighting and appliances that can save you energy and money. Last year, the DCSU served 19,000 district households through renewable and efficient energy services. Call 202-479-2222 or visit dcseu.com to start saving money and energy today.
Imagine standing at the open door of a helicopter, hovering in the middle of a storm, preparing to jump into the rough ocean below. Dangerous search and rescue missions are just one of the countless ways members of our nation's sea services put themselves at risk to protect us all. Support the members of our Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and U.S. Flag Merchant Marine by enrolling as a member of the Navy League of the United States, an advocate and voice for our nation's sea services. Learn more at NavyLeague.org.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and Federal News
Radio. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for